Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Dear Old World, my interview podcast where I bring on my friends and coworkers and we talk about the stuff that we have made together. Today, my guest is the wonderful Margaret Dunlap, whom you will know if you are a fan of a show I was in back in 2012 called The Lizzie Bennet Diaries. Yes, Margaret was a writer on the very same. She wrote one of my biggest episodes, episode 20, along with many other wonderful episodes, and she's a wonderful friend and writer. And this interview that I originally did with her is back from summer of 2020, so it is 3 years old now, but she still has lots of great insights into just the process of making the Lizzie Bennet Diaries, advice for aspiring writers, and I just wanted to bring her, or I wanted to make this interview public to highlight her as a wonderful member of the WGA, whom you all know is on strike right now, and we need to be supporting our WGA friends and hoping that the AMPTP comes to their senses and everybody can get back to work soon. Before I get into this chat with Margaret, I just want to give a quick update that I am currently running a Kickstarter. Yes, I am raising funds for a project all by myself. If you follow me, you know I have done this with Shipwrecked Comedy 4 times now. But this is my first one all on my own, and it is for a little travel show that I have thought up called Hobbit Houses of America. I made a proof of concept episode of this show featuring a Hobbit house that I visited in Russellville, Arkansas, that you can see on my YouTube channel. And I'm asking for $20,000 to help me film 3 more episodes featuring Hobbit houses all over the country. Because guess what, you guys? There's a lot of Hobbit houses here in America. And if you know me, you know my dream is to go to New Zealand someday and see Hobbiton. But I kind of have a desire to see all the ones that are here first. So I finally got up the courage to just try and fund a little travel series. And I just launched the Kickstarter yesterday when I'm recording this. The response has been super positive so far, but I'm only about a third of the way funded and I still have a couple weeks, so there's some time. August 20th is the final day if you want to join me on this journey together. I hope that you will consider it. I'm really nervous and excited to do something totally brand new, but something that I have desired to do. Hosting a travel show has like just kind of always been in the back of my mind as something that I would really like to try. And so I'm really excited. So anyway, go check that out if that sounds up your alley. And without further ado, let's get into the chat with Margaret. Hi, Margaret.
Hey, Mary Kate. So nice to see you.
It is so good to see you again. Thank you again so much for agreeing to chat with me. It's nice to, I don't know, talk to people during this.
It is so vital. No, thank you for having me. I remember when this was all starting earlier in the years, and there was like a bunch of, I feel like there were a bunch of articles that were all like, interaction over, you know, over Zoom or video call. It's not the same. It's not real interaction. And I'm like, if you don't live alone, call me up and tell me that.
Yeah, exactly. Also, like, I'll take it.
Yeah.
How has your quarantine been?
You know, all things considered, my quarantine has been pretty good. I am fortunately very busy with professional stuff, and that is good both in terms of having money to live on and having a job, which we like both of these things, but also yeah. It gives me something to focus on, and so it's not just doom scrolling on news sites or Twitter or stuff like that, because like I find that I really do need to sort of pace my intake. I can only be outraged and active, and then I need to take a little bit of a breather.
Definitely can relate to that. Well, can you tell us about any of the things you've been working on?
That is an excellent question. I don't think I can. It's in that point, it's like, no, it's all under an NDA, which of course makes all of your projects seem way more exciting than they perhaps actually are. But yeah, none of them have been announced yet, so I have to stay quiet.
Well, I'm very glad that you are working on cool things that you can't tell us about. That's awesome.
Thank you. Me too. I'm really excited to be able to tell people about them.
If you don't mind, I would love to sort of have you just kind of take us through your, I don't know, just kind of like journey in terms of becoming a writer and like how you started out and what sort of led to where you are now, if you don't mind to share.
Oh, certainly. How far back are we starting on this? Because this can be a long story or it can be a really long story, I think.
As long as you want it to be. Whatever you feel like is pertinent info, I would love to hear.
Well, let's see. I will try to tell this completely but efficiently. Let's try for that. The idea that writing was something that I might want to do, like, beyond something you have to do as a class assignment, I really didn't come into that until college. And I had a weird gap in my schedule, and I wound up taking a playwriting class, which I suppose says something about me, that it's like, oh, there's a weird gap in my schedule. What should I fill it with? Playwriting. But my roommate was taking it, and I figured, well, if she can do it, I can probably do it. And that sort of was that first, you know, the first experience I had talking about story structure and the idea that stories were not just these sort of magical things born of whole cloth, like Athena from Zeus's head. But, you know, there are patterns, there are archetypes, there's sort of, you know, the rhythms of it. It turned storytelling into something that's like, oh, this is something, it becomes a puzzle that I can figure out. So that's how I really got started. And then eventually I came out to Los Angeles to do my master's.
Where are you from originally again?
I'm from Southwest Virginia. We moved to Texas when I was in junior high, and then I went to college in Massachusetts. But I was living in Boston for a couple of years after college and, you know, doing that sort of couple of years after college, learning how to be something other than a student for the first time in my life, which was, you know, it was a challenge for me. I assume it's a challenge for most people. But then eventually I came out to LA. I knew I wanted to write for television because I love television storytelling. I got my master's in screenwriting from USC. It's not necessary to have a career as a professional screenwriter, but for me, I was like, I'm moving to a city. I don't know anybody. I know it's a hard industry to break into. If I do the graduate program, I will move there and I'll meet 31 other people that I have at least one thing in common with. And that was sort of the basic sort of friend group and peer group, really, that got me started out here. So I did the program, and then I spent about 4.5 years working in the entertainment industry, more or less unsuccessfully, but eventually I had a mentor who I did meet through the USC program. He sold a show to ABC Family, and we'd stayed in touch, and he called me up and is like, okay, I can't sell you as a staff writer, but I'm going to hire you as the writer's assistant, and we're going to give you one of the freelance episodes in the first season. And that's what ended up happening. The show, alas, did not last past that first season, but I had the freelance credit. I went on, I was a writer's assistant on, you know, 4 seasons of television on 3 more shows, because a lot of shows don't make it past their first season, as we all know, either as professionals or as viewers. And then, actually, it was right around then that we met, because I was coming off my last show where I was an assistant that got canceled, when I was having coffee with Bernie, and he mentioned this project he had. It's like, yeah, no, this guy, Hank, has an idea to take literature in the public domain and do vlog-style adaptations for a young female audience. And I said something to him like, oh, so you're going to do like Pride and Prejudice on YouTube? And he says, actually, we're doing exactly Pride and Prejudice on YouTube. And he pretty much offered me a job.
So how did you know Bernie in the first place then?
I knew Bernie kind of socially through LA geekdom. I run into him at a couple of recordings of, I think, the, called Ben Blacker's podcast, the one he does with all of the writers, and he'd do live records not far from where I lived at a comic shop. He did the records at a comic shop. I did not live at a comic shop. I am a professional constructor of sentences, I swear. But yeah, I'd sort of run into him socially in those kinds of circles, and that was also the period where Bernie was running around taking pictures of everything, and so I'd sort of met him through that.
That's how I first met him, too.
Yeah, it's Bernie. He's taking pictures of stuff. And yeah, and I think one of the reasons he approached me for Lizzie Bennet is he had done, he'd done at least one web series, possibly two at that point. He had a couple of other things in development, and he already had tapped Rachel Kiley, and I think Liz had introduced him to Jay Bushman. I think one of the reasons he tapped me for the project was like, oh, Margaret's actually worked in TV. That will probably be helpful. So yeah, so that was coming in, and we eventually built the team, and we added other writers like Kate Rorick, Anne Toole. And yeah, so we did Lizzie, we did Sanditon. I had like a cup of coffee on Emma Approved.
I was going to ask, I couldn't remember if you had also worked at all on Emma Approved or not.
Only a little bit. That was mostly Kate, and she was writing a bunch of episodes and said, she basically called me in for this one. And I'm like, okay, well, I dragged you into Lizzie Bennet. This is only fair. So yeah, I think I have like four episodes on that.
Was this your first time writing for web on Lizzie Bennet?
Yeah. Yeah, that was my first web series.
Did you feel like it was really different from writing for TV?
You know, this is going to sound weird to a web series savvy audience, but the TV I had worked on had been some really low budget stuff. So the idea that we have to write within these constraints and we don't have just infinite piles of money to throw at things, that was something that I was useful. Getting used to the vlog format, and so much of it we were just sort of creating as we went. I remember we were doing just sample episodes so we'd have audition material for people, and I was writing something and I said to Bernie, can there be a doorway behind her while she's blogging so people can be coming in and out? And he's like, are you sure? I'm like, it helps me out a lot. And he's like, okay. And we put it there, and thank goodness we had that door there, because all of a sudden there's some suspense, there's depth of field, it feels like you've got this whole world through that door. You know, jokes about, Lizzie, why don't you ever lock your door, and why does nobody ever knock before they come into your bedroom aside? I think some of the later shoots, when we were doing Pemberley Digital, we had three angles at Pemberley Digital. We'd gotten very sophisticated by then. And only one of them had a door, and you could feel the difference when it's just a wall behind, because there's just like, you're not wondering, it's like, ooh, is someone going to come through that door? Mm-hmm.
That's so interesting. Wow, you came up with a lot of things that, like, to me seem like so obviously a part of like what the show would be, and that's thanks to you. I never would have even thought of that.
I was literally writing a scene. I'm like, it'd be nice if someone could come through the door. Why don't I put it in frame? And that's sort of how it went.
Was it weird to be writing just in terms of like the length, because the Lizzie Bennet episodes are so short as opposed to, you know, like a 30-minute TV show?
Yeah, it was definitely something that we discussed a lot starting out, because we knew that we were aiming initially for 3 to 5 minute episodes, and they got a little bit longer as we went on. But also, by the time you're at episode 73, like, you've got some audience buy-in. It's, you know, somebody just sampling in. It's like, you know, it's like, oh, here's a web series, I'll check it out. It's like longer than 5 minutes. You know, your odds of hitting play, it felt like those were going to go down. And so one of the things we definitely discussed early on was the idea that, like, something has to happen in every episode. It can't just be we've taken a bigger scene and cut it up into smaller chunks. Like, even, you know, there'd be that element of a cliffhanger, or the what's happens next, or, you know, Lizzie or whoever would be asking a question of the audience to sort of drive that engagement. But there was always, you got a little new information, there were always some good jokes, there was, like, the candy was always there. You didn't get to the end of the episode and feel like, well, this was just connecting interesting things that are happening on either side. And I always felt like that was a really important deal we were making with our audience.
I have been reminiscing, so in each episode of this podcast, I'm going to, like, sort of talk about a different project and this, and like my own, just like, by myself, like, reminiscing about it and sharing stories about it. And so for this episode, I'm talking about LBD. So I've already been sort of just like reflecting on that time and thinking about all that and how just wild it was. It was so wild. And so I guess I'm wondering, like, obviously for us as actors, like going to cons and like all of a sudden being in something that was so popular, was so new, and I don't know, just crazy. What was that like as a writer? Did you also feel like, how was that experience for you? Had you been in, had you worked on something that had, I mean, you'd done TV, but like what we were experiencing on Lizzie Bennet just seemed like so bizarre and unlike anything else, at least for me.
Absolutely. It was one of those lightning in a bottle kind of experiences in so many ways. You know, when we started out, like it was just, it was kind of this weird side project, right? It was like, yeah, we're shooting in our producer's bedroom and, you know, Hank had the Vlogbrothers, he's doing all of that, you know, Bernie's got a couple things going on. It's like, yeah, it's an experiment and we'll see how it goes. And there's sort of, I think we initially had budget to do 3 months worth of episodes, and there's sort of the feeling of like, well, who knows if we're ever gonna do more than those first 3 months of episodes. And you were there, we had our first shoot, and you know, Bernie's like, we're shooting an entire month's worth of content in a day. And coming out of TV, my response to that was pretty much, okay, and what's your fallback when that's impossible? Because, you know, we shot like, you know, it was a 46-page day or something. And, you know, I was talking to Stuart, our assistant director, who did the call sheet, and he's just like, I feel like they're going to pull my union card or something. I made a call sheet that said our pages today are 46 and a half. But we did, because it was such a lean operation, you know, that the camera didn't move, the lighting didn't really change that much. The turnover between episodes was you guys changing, you know, wardrobe, hair, and makeup pretty much. And that was, you know, efficient as you guys always were. It was like maybe 20 minutes and then we'd be back in shooting the next one. And then we went live and those first episodes came out, and I think Hank like threw us something on one of the vlogs saying, hey, I have this experiment. And he'd said, I think his estimate was like, you know, I could maybe throw 10,000 views at you guys. And within weeks, we were hitting 60,000 views on one episode before the next episode came out. It was just took off from jump in a way that was just, you know, insane. Like, we, like, what's the big struggle of a web series? You have to let people know you're there and get people to watch. And they did. And then they kept coming back. And then, like you said, it's like, and there was press, and we started going to conventions. And that first VidCon, I remember the signing line and seeing it just like stretching down the room and around it, and just being like, these people all lined up for us. Like, we get to the panel 20 minutes early, the room is already full. And, you know, because it's all like, we know people are watching and commenting on the videos, but then all of a sudden it's like, oh, these actual people who are coming to a physical place to see us. LeakyCon was insane and wonderful, and just the fans so excited and so positive and giving. And I remember then at some point in spring, we're still airing episodes, and it's like right around Darcy Day, I want to say, was also the 200th anniversary of the publication of Pride and Prejudice. And it's like, man, I wish we could say that we'd planned that.
Well, it was good timing.
It was good timing. And I think, you know, it was not our only bit of good timing. And I don't say this to, you know, to try to talk down the quality of the show, because I'm really proud of the work that everybody did on that show. The writers, the actors, the crew, you know, top to bottom. But we were also, you know, 8 years ago, there wasn't a lot of scripted video content online for a specifically female audience. You had shopping and you had beauty blogs and you had a lot of lifestyle sort of stuff, but there wasn't that sort of, that storytelling itch was not being scratched in that same way. And we came and the niche was pretty empty when we showed up. And there was an audience hungry for the content. And it was like, yes, this is what we have been wanting. And it was just, you know, 5 years earlier, the technology wouldn't have been there for it. 5 years later, somebody else would have come up with the idea already, and we would have been lost in the shuffle. So it's always nice to work on a quality project with good people that also finds a large and enthusiastic audience. Because as we know, you can do really good work on good projects and people don't find it, or it doesn't hit the zeitgeist right. And it's just like, you know, all you have is the comfort of your good work.
It definitely is something that you can't ever predict or quantify. It just happens. And I don't know. We were so lucky that it happened to us. It was unlike anything I think any of us will ever really experience again.
It was. We were the right team with the right project at the right moment. And you've just got to, when something like that happens, it's just you hang on and try to appreciate every moment of it that you can, I think.
It's so true. Well, I have to thank you because, I mean, as most people who are Lizzie Bennet fans know, like, Rachel Kiley obviously became, like, very much sort of the Lydia writer as the show went on. But you wrote episode 20, which was Lydia's most Lydia's most iconic episode. And honestly, for me, like, episode 20 was when I finally feel like Lydia locked in for me. Because the first few episodes, I still was, like, trying to figure out who she was. And I also had never played a character like her before. And I'm not really like her myself as a person. And so, like, I was playing a lot more characters like Zelda in Squaresville, who are, like, kind of, like, punky and, like, weird and, you know, not, like, mainstream, like, a little off the beaten path. And so, like, I felt like I had a pretty good idea of, like, how to play Lydia going into this. And clearly, I guess Bernie agreed, you know. But I was also at the same time just kind of felt like a fraud a little bit, because I was like, I don't know, like, if any of this is, like, really ringing true, like, beyond a stereotype of, like, a party girl. And so, yeah, episode 20 was, like, really kind of when I started to be like, okay, I get who Lydia is, and, like, I feel comfortable and actually, like, love playing her, because that was so fun. Such a fun episode.
That makes me so happy. I don't remember if I played my senior writer card to be like, no, I want that episode. I know I definitely wanted to write it. And I'm really glad I did, because it was like, you know, it's like, oh, I got to write Lydia. Like, that was my checking that one off the life list, because Rachel really did, you know, that character really kind of became hers in a lot of ways, or between the two of you. But I was so glad I got a chance that I wrote that episode. And it's like, it was such a fun off-speed pitch, and doing, that was the one where Lydia takes over the vlog. The fake haul video was like the gag I knew I wanted to do. And it was so fun to write. And it's so interesting to hear you talk about how you were struggling to find the character, because I remember when Bernie sent me the first batch of, I was there for the callbacks, but he sent me videos of the preliminary auditions, and he sent, like, you know, these are our top X number of Lizzie's and Lydia's and Charlotte's and Jane's. And I watched the Lydia's and I called him up and I'm like, so we're hiring Mary-Kate, right? Like, you just blew it out of the water. And that's like, nope. That's who she is. And so I think as the character evolved, like, we were picking up from you and from all of the cast, just sort of learning, like, okay, where is their strike zone? Because you can create a character in your head, but as soon as there's an actor or an animation art and a voice attached to that, that to me is always one of the things that helps to lock the character. They stop being the idea of a character. And when I'm writing Lydia, I'm not writing, you know, this character with these desires who's accomplishing this to move this episode forward. It's like, all of that's there, but it's also, can I hear Mary-Kate saying this line? Is this gonna work? Like, you know, can I hear her talking to Ashley and nope, yeah, that's gonna work, or this doesn't sound quite right. And so it's not so much the direct collaboration, but it is that just sort of across the page. One of my favorite memories of doing Lizzie Bennet was, I mean, because the shoot was always fun, but also it's like there's a lot of pressure and we're trying to get through everything and we can't turn on the air conditioner. So in summer, we're all just dead of how hot it is. But we would shoot on Saturdays and like Wednesday, I want to say, Wednesday or Thursday. I think Wednesday, because I think we wanted to give Ashley 2 full days with the script before we asked her to, because she was on nearly every page. But we'd do rehearsals with, and we'd bring you guys in and read through, and that would be, and I was always there and just sitting with the script and going through and be like, okay, this we can make better. This, it worked on the page. It's not selling when we try to get it on its feet. And it's that sort of, that last kind of series of revisions before we get to putting it in front of the camera. That was always a lot of fun.
Yeah, that was something I talked about as I was reminiscing about it on my own. Like the fact that you guys were so like generous in allowing us, especially as the show went on, like, and it became very clear that we, I mean, for me too, it was the first time I was like playing a character in an ongoing situation. Normally I would just, you're on a shoot for 2 weeks and then like that's it, but we just all got really obviously involved in playing these characters because we were doing it for a whole year. You guys were always super cool to like let us have input as the show went on and like let us sort of change stuff that we didn't feel like rang true for us or whatever, or like add in suggestions or improvs or whatever. And I'm really glad that we could. It was very collaborative.
I mean, it was nobody's primary job, but it was kind of everybody's full-time job for a year. Yeah. Because either, you know, from the writer's side, we were either having our meeting to break episodes, or we were writing rough drafts of episodes, or they're coming back and I was doing revisions or sending notes out, and then we're taking to rehearsal, and then there's another pass, and then we're shooting, and like takes Sunday off, and then Monday the whole cycle starts again with the next batch of scripts coming in. And it really was that sort of, I mean, and it wasn't a weekly cycle because we were only shooting once a month, but like at the time I could tell you exactly what week one, week two, week three, week of the shoot looks like. And it was just that constant presence that I think was in all of our heads, was, you know, what you're doing your survival job, or you're working something else, or you're walking the dog, and it's just at the back of your head. It's like the Lizzie Bennet clock is sort of going of like, when's it coming? You know, I'm sure for you guys, like, when are we getting the new pages? What's it going to look like? And I think one of the strengths of the show was, you know, as you said, like collaborating with the actors, and, you know, not that we said yes to absolutely everything, but, you know, helping you guys shape those characters, because they're also you. It's your face up there. You're delivering the lines. If you don't believe it or can't sell it, it's not gonna work. But also on the writer's side, like, if you're paying attention, you can tell, like, different writers have a slightly different feel on the material. And it always feels like Lizzie Bennet, but you start, you know, I'm sure our viewers start to recognize, like, oh, it's a Rachel Kiley episode, that's a Kate episode, that's a Margaret episode, that's a Bernie or a Jay, or however those sort of go. I remember being at rehearsal one time, and I will confess to, I enjoy big words and long sentences, which is one of the reason why writing for Mr. Collins and even Darcy were always a particular joy, because you could just bust out the $5 word vocabulary. Have fun, Max. But there was one sentence I'd written, and we run through rehearsal, and Ashley's like, this is a very Margaret Dunlap sentence, and I think it's a little too, and I'm like, no, we can cut a clause or two from that. It's just like, you made the point, and then it kept going. And I'm like, no, fair, I may have gilded the lily there on that one. We can cut it back.
Well, considering that it was like not, it certainly wasn't my only gig at the time, were you working on anything else during that year, like writing-wise?
I'm sure I was. I wasn't on a TV show at the time.
That probably would have been very difficult to juggle, because even though, you know, I clearly was like still a big time commitment for you guys on the writing end, maybe probably more than it was for us on the acting end, because we, you know, had some rehearsals and then we just had to show up once a month. But we were also starting that summer, going to cons and like doing all this extra outside sort of appearance stuff.
Yeah, I was doing, you know, like many of us do as we build our career, like I was doing a lot of weird side gigs, and I think I might have started doing book burners for Cereal Box around that time. I must have had some other paying work going in, like, you know, I wasn't living in a cardboard box, so there must have been something. I also had a pilot in development back then, but that's the sort of thing where it's like, could do that, and working with that production company, it wasn't, you know, necessarily. Yeah, I remember telling Bernie, it's like, I love you and I love this project, but if I get staffed, I'm gonna have to leave the show. And he's like, yeah, no, we get it.
Of course. I mean, that was kind of the situation for everybody at that level, which was,
yeah, we were all kind of bracing ourselves for what was gonna happen when the rest of Hollywood figured out how amazing you guys were and hired you out from under us.
Well, it didn't happen, so
we skated through on that. We're like, it's not that we don't want success for these people, but can you have success after shoot 12? No, and we would have found a way around it if we'd had to.
Yeah, I mean, being able to shoot, only shooting like one day a month really did make it, I don't know.
Yeah, it's like, you know, even if it's a thing, we can probably scam a Saturday afternoon to just finish things out if we really have to. Yeah, I remember joking with somebody because you all were such great friends and that lasted through the entire year. And I'm like, I think the secret may be that we only force them to be with each other one day a month. Like, they don't have time to be annoyed by each other's tics because they're not working 16-hour days, 6 days a week.
It's true. We really didn't. We were, like, so close. I mean, I think, like, you know, the more we went on trips and stuff, we, like, but, like, there wasn't any time where I was like, ugh, I don't want to be around this person. I was always, like, so excited to hang out with everybody and do things. And
Yeah. I think it's sort of, you know, you have people who, you know, it goes beyond the sort of we all work together friendship into a more personal friendship. And that's natural. But I don't know that there's anybody in the cast who's like, there are no weird blood feuds that I am aware of. No, I remember the LeakyCon hotel room roulette where it was sort of like, okay, who's sharing rooms?
Yes.
But even that was pretty easy to do.
That was so fun when we all were at that one Leaky, and it was just, gosh, it was just a blast.
No, I also remember, it's like, oh my God, it's like really pulling out my co-EP hat and being like, okay, I'm everybody's handler. And just that moment of like, can you take us around to the back of the hotel? Because I want these people to be able to get to their rooms tonight, and we cannot cross the lobby. They'll never make it.
You were such a good handler, and I'm sorry that you had to do that. You deserve a lot more credit for like how, I mean, I think it was, again, that first VidCon where we just, I mean, we knew the show was popular, but we couldn't have imagined what that actually meant. And I remember at times, like, having been signing and meeting people for, like, an hour and, like, looking at you, and you could just see, like, how tired we were, and you'd be like, all right, let's go.
We're done, you know. Like, I am going to be the person like, no, I'm sorry, we're late for press. We all have to go now. And that way, you know, you guys can all be sorry and smile and make your regrets, and I'm going to get you out of that. But that was, I really learned that from my first showrunner boss on The Middleman, Javier Grigio-Marx Watch. Just watching him, like, bringing the cast to Comic-Con or doing that in real, you know, to him, it's very much part of the job. Like, if you are an upper level writer producer, one of my main tasks is I take care of my cast. And that means, you know, writing, you know, making sure the scripts are where they need to be, making sure we're getting you stuff early enough that you can learn lines, that you're not, you know, getting pages on the set if we can avoid it at all. And, you know, at those sort of public things of realizing it's like, it's a thing if Mary Kate, you know, runs out of patience and somebody asks her for an autograph and she says no. It's like, I will be the jerk, who stands between, so that never needs to happen.
Well, you really did take such great care of us, and I do appreciate that so much.
And the Lizzie Bennet fans were all so sweet. Like, the only...
So lovely.
It was an overabundance of enthusiasm at the end of a long day. It was ever the only thing that was a problem.
Oh, yeah, no, people were always so lovely. It was just that there were so many of them, and we only had so much bandwidth to say hello to everyone and have a quick, you know, personal chat with everybody, which, yeah. Again, like, how lucky were we that that was, I think we were all surprised and amazed.
Do you remember when we'd sort of, like, come in the back doors to the lobby of the hotel, and we've gotten everybody into the elevator, there's no one else in the elevator, we're heading up to the floor, and, like, it opens on the third floor, and there's this girl and her mother, and there's just this moment, and I'm sure they could sort of see from everyone's expressions, like, these people are so tired. And I remember her mom went, the girl's mom, she goes, "Oh my God, you're the cast of the Lizzie Bennet Diaries." And we're like, "Yeah, yeah, they are." And she's like, "Will you take a picture with my daughter really quick? She's too shy to ask." And so literally with the open doors of the elevator, she came, stood, her mom took a photo, and then they stepped out and they let the elevator continue up to our floor.
That's so sweet. I don't remember that, but I'm sure that that did happen. That's so sweet.
It was adorable.
It was wonderful. It was, yeah, I don't know. It was just cool. We got like a very cool level of fame where we got to feel really neat and famous, and everybody was sweet, but there were some times that were like not as great, but for the most part we just never had anybody be awful or, you know, the things about fame that are not so good.
I remember being so excited for all of you guys at that convention, and the people at the con were great for, you know, they treated you all really well and everything that's going on. And I think wandering around the floor during that weekend, three people recognized me. And I remember having the thought of, like, you know what? Three people recognizing me is a pretty good level of recognition. Like, I can walk around. For the most part, I'm anonymous. But, you know, but it's nice to occasionally have that moment of, it's like, oh my God, it's the cast of Lizzie Bennet Diaries. And this guy standing right next to me, he tries to say, oh my God, it's you. And I'm like, you are pretty deep into fandom if you can recognize me by sight. You have done your behind-the-scenes homework. It's like, I wish Katie Most were here to see if you could recognize our production designer.
Yeah, right, exactly. It was so fun. It was such a fun time. Well, I have some questions from my patrons, and they're all about LBD.
Awesome.
If you don't mind. I would like to also talk about your life post-LBD, but since we're on the topic.
Since we're here.
Yeah, all right. So Emily asks, are there any LBD characters whose voices you found particularly easy to write from, and which character arc was your favorite to create?
Ooh, all right. Well, confession time on character voices being particularly easy to write. Lizzie's voice is very similar to my voice. I wrote enough episodes, and I wrote enough of them early, and I was doing a lot of the passes. I just threw, but this sounds good and natural to me. And fortunately, it's not that far off of Ashley's sort of natural diction, so it was simpler for her. The challenge for that was when we were working on Sanditon, I had to make sure that Gigi's vlogs didn't sound like Lizzie's. Like, it had to be a conscious thought to shift gears. So it's like, oh, I'm writing an episode of one of these web series and it starts with a vlog, and I have to make sure it doesn't sound like the way that Lizzie would do it. And also, there's so much Lizzie, it becomes the default voice of the show. In terms of story arcs, I've always, since I first read the book, been a Charlotte partisan, and telling Charlotte's story of the friendship with Lizzie, taking the job with Mr. Collins, working through sort of both of their feelings around that. And because I feel like a lot of times that's a character who sort of gets the sort of, you know, shorthand of like gold digger, you know, or compromises her values. And I'm like, no, she's making very sensible decisions. and they work out pretty well for her. And so that was, I always liked Charlotte. I also have a soft spot for nerds because I am one.
I think you guys did such a great job with, I mean, with adapting everything from the book, like all of these big plot points in the book and the ways in which we changed them for the show, I think are great. But I really like what we did with Charlotte and Collins. And
yeah, well, it's one of the weird things, like, for as short as our episodes were, we are the longest video adaptation of Pride and Prejudice ever made. Like, we're longer than the 95 miniseries. We have room to let those secondary characters breathe. I mean, we have room to really tell Lydia's story not as an object moral lesson for, you know, honestly, for the reader, kind of. It's like, oh, this is what happens if you're silly and chase after boys. Yeah, we have room for everybody to sort of be a, you know, except Wickham. He's just kind of a jerk. We did not do a great job of humanizing Wickham. He's just like, yeah, no, this guy's a loser and we hate him.
I mean, he's terrible, so I think it's fine. But, I mean, again, like on that same note, I like that we get to show kind of an emotionally abusive relationship there, because, you know, like, yeah, it's there, and that's something worth, like, considering. And anyway, I think you guys did a great job with all of it, and it was so fun.
No, and I know on some of those episodes, you'd start seeing in the comments, you know, people were sharing resources, and this is my experience, and these are, and it's like, that's great. Like, not only did we inspire people to read Jane Austen, but also,
oh my gosh, I mean, I've gotten so many messages about, like, people relating to Lydia throughout that whole thing, and, like, how much that was helpful for them to either be able to, like, realize that they were in a bad relationship, or help them feel less alone having experienced one. So, I mean, that's really cool.
That's really awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, not awesome that people are having bad experiences, right, but it's always nice when art can help you through a bad time.
Exactly. That is the goal. Well, Jill asks, do you have a favorite episode that somebody else wrote? And were any episodes particularly easy or hard to write?
Let's see. A favorite episode that somebody else wrote. I will be honest, it's been 8 years. They start to blur a little bit.
There are 100 of them.
There are 100 of them, plus Q&A episodes.
Yep.
Plus the, I will say, what Rachel, and I'm not just saying this because I'm on your podcast, but what Rachel did with the Lydia vlogs was some really high quality work. It's so, anytime we did a spinoff, it's so hard, and those, it really sang, and, you know, and it's a credit to both of you.
That was a lot of, I'm so glad we got to do it. I remember that, like, I don't know, I just remember at first Bernie was like, yeah, like, let's do it, Lydia, so people really like Lydia, this will be fun. And then as it went on, and I think we realized, like, ooh, we could really, like, delve into some things on this. I feel like he was, like, not sure if he really wanted to, and I'm glad that we got the opportunity to do all of that.
The Lydia spinoff was originally because we realized that Jane and Lizzie were spending a month at Bing's place, because we, at that point, were like, we can't move the camera on one shoot day, it's impossible, so, like, they had to be there the whole month. But we realized, because there was just, they're the people who loved Lydia. Like, we don't want to go for a month without having her on screen. So she's staying with her cousin Mary because she also can't be at the house.
And I'm so glad, yeah, that we, like, got to have Mary in the show because of that, who's so great. And their dynamic is so fun and so, like, just ripe for comedic content. It's so funny.
I know. I was so excited when we got to have Mary on the main series, because we're like, oh, somebody else gets to write Mary lines.
Yeah, it's so true. Man, that episode is one of my favorites.
I finally got to meet her because I wasn't at the at those shoots for you guys, because that was such a bare bones operation. Yeah, not an episode, but I was. The fact that we turned Kitty into Lydia's actual cat who just follows her around is one of those dumb jokes that still cracks me up.
it's Rosie's birthday today, and I Instagrammed, happy birthday, Rosie. I Instagrammed, and multiple people were like, the best Kitty Bennett there's ever been. And I'm like, that is such an insult to Carrie Mulligan. Like, thank you so much, but no.
And you can follow her because she's on Twitter.
I also remember you at VidCon commenting that your cat had more Twitter followers than you had.
For a long time.
Tension in the household.
Yeah, for a long time. I finally surpassed her, but yeah, I was very jealous.
Yeah, I would have been too.
James had a question sort of about, like, I'll just read it. You've kind of talked about this already. What was the process of figuring out how to write a vlog? Was it something the writer's room did all at once, or did you all bring your own ideas and write each episode semi-independently? Could you just expound a little bit about, like, how you guys wrote each episode or each chunk of episodes?
Yeah. No, that's great. So the process that we worked out, that we eventually worked out, it was pretty quick. But we would meet in a conference room at the Writers Guild, usually. We'd meet and say, okay, this is the next chunk of book that we're going to get through in the next month, which would be the upcoming shoot. And we'd look at, that would be 8 episodes. So you'd sort of have these 8 slots, and we're like, okay, what happens in this chunk of book? Or as we were getting towards the end, like, okay, what do we need to cover before we get to the end? Because when we started out, we didn't know how long it was going to run. So, like, the pacing was a little, it's like, when we finally said, it's like, okay, 12 months, that's going to be the end of the book, then we knew. But we looked at the events that we wanted to cover, and then break that into, okay, so the first episode of the shoot is going to be, this, and then that'll lead to this, and kind of break it out. And once we knew what the kernel of each of those episodes was going to be, then we would assign those to the writers based on, who was there, who was available that month, how much time everyone had. I frequently, since I was, I do not want to undercut Bernie's contributions, but frequently I'd sort of be running the room. And I'd usually let the staff, if somebody is like, oh, I want to do this one, oh, I want to do this one, and then I'd sort of like, I'd wind up writing the oddball or kind of filler episodes in between, which I never minded because it's always an interesting challenge to take, like, all right, there's this one thing that needs to happen in this episode, but it doesn't necessarily scream what the story is going to be. And so finding interesting gags or a good emotional moment that you can hang all of that on. Like, that was always a puzzle that I enjoyed, and I always figured, it's like, look, I'm doing a bunch of the rewrites. My grubby fingerprints are going to be all over these at some point anyway, so I don't need to, and I tried to, Bernie as well, we tried not to, like, drastically rewrite people. It's like, life is short, and you don't need to, it's like, create more work by not letting the people who you've hired to do a job do the job that you hired them to do. So we might not give them a lot more than this is the episode, this is what needs to happen in it, because they were so short. You're writing 5 to 8 pages. There's not a lot of detailed story breaking that we do. Also, we didn't have a ton of time. We'd send people off to draft, they return the rough drafts. Bernie or I would give notes and send them back to the writer, if we needed to, or if there was time. If the episode was basically in good shape, it'd be like, great, do whatever tweaks we wanted. That would be then, after that pass, that would be the draft that would go out to the cast. You guys would get the pages, come in for rehearsal, we'd run everything. Then we'd do another set of revisions overnight, send them back to you guys, because we learned that there is an upward number of pages that you can shoot in a single day. I think one month we tried to shoot like 60, like it was originally scheduled for 64 pages, and that was too many. 56 is about the limit. And we were sitting there, I remember sitting there on the floor with a couple of other writers saying, okay, what can we cut down to make this, And we're like, all right, let's not do that again. We know how we've hit our ceiling.
But the thing that let us do that many pages was having good script to you guys at least 48 hours before the shoot. Because I know, you know, Ashley basically had took those 2 days to memorize. And she had, you know, we had a music stand for her if she needed a cheat sheet. But we all realized early on, it goes so much faster. It's so much more smooth the more that she already had memorized.
And also, like, she would have to have, like, stuff that she was just sort of delivering to camera she could kind of look at. But if it was a scene where somebody came in, like, you know, that was all, that had to be memorized because it was spur of the moment in the show.
Yeah, and we would have these 2 or 3 page dialogues between two characters sometimes, and after those early episodes, we stopped cutting because there shouldn't be any cuts because you're just voyeuristically watching on the webcam. And you guys were all such champs about that. I remember when we were doing initial casting, Jenny Powell, our producer, commenting to me that she looked specifically for people who had theater and improv work on their resumes. And that turned out to be such an asset on a project like this because, you know, you're used to doing things in big chunks or to making, you know, saving the scene and moving it forward.
Yeah, that's so true. I hadn't really thought about that, especially just for this format of show where you're playing to camera, but like that camera is at the same time like a huge audience that's like, you know, all over the world. So you are kind of playing as if you're in a theater. Well, it was a cool time.
It really was. It's a great team, and you know, it's like people I'm still in touch with who I met on that, and that's always nice because working on a show, it's frequently a lot like summer camp. You have these very intense, very concentrated friendships, and then at the end of summer, everyone sort of goes their separate ways, like, we're totally gonna write, and then you may or may not ever see them again. And it always makes me happy when I see, it's like, oh yeah. It's like when I see you and Ashley did something together, or, you know, here, I'm like, oh yeah, everyone's still hanging out.
It definitely, I think, has shaped all of our lives in such a big way, in such a... Yeah. Tangible way in terms of friendships.
Yeah. On the writer's side as well.
Yeah, and projects and all of that. Well, take us through a little bit. I mean, again, it's been 8 years, but like, what are some of the things you've worked on since then?
Let's see. Since Lizzie Bennet, I briefly mentioned Book Burners, which is a serial fiction ebook and audio series from a publisher called Serial Box that I wound up working on. They call them seasons and episodes, but it's prose. But we did 5 years of that. I've done a couple other projects for Serial Box in the meantime. Recently, Serial Box has a franchise with Marvel, and they were doing a Black Widow serial. And one of the founders, he calls me up and is like, so do you want to write for Black Widow? I'm like, I'm drinking tea from my Black Widow mug right now. Yes, I do. Yeah. The answer to that is yes. So that just came out earlier this year in 2020. So that's been exciting. I've been teaching. I've been writing for a bunch of animated series, both kids and not for kids, frequently at the same time, which is a lot of fun when you need a palate cleanser between, like, Barbie Dreamhouse Adventures, which is, you know, also girl-focused, very positive sort of show, but I think the biggest problem I have ever given Barbie to deal with is the jerk boys who want to use the same spot of the beach as she and her friends are on. It's not a particularly high stakes show. So it was nice when I was working on that to have another project I was on at the same time where it's like, and now I will, you know, I'll go shake that off and write about, you know, people getting stabbed in rainy alleys a lot. So
do you feel like it's different writing for animation versus live action?
It is and it isn't. It's funny actually, because as I was getting started writing for animated shows was also when I was writing for Dark Crystal, Age of Resistance. And so I sort of feel like I had the spectrum of live action puppets and then drawn animation. The stories aren't so different, even if your audience is different. Writing, you know, the structure of a story, it's not that different whether it's a kid audience or a preschool audience or an adult audience. But the difference is in who is reading the script and who your audience is. You know, when I started in TV and live action, and the web series world is similar, you know, I'm writing, especially in Lizzie Bennet, I'm writing for you guys. And also, I know I'm going to be there on set. So, you know, the action line for a lot of Lizzie Bennet episodes began with Lizzie vlogs. And that's pretty much it and all anybody needed. But writing for actors and directors, I knew how to talk to actors and directors through the script. For an animated script, you're writing for this primarily for the director and for, you know, storyboard artists and then later animators who are going to be bringing everything to life. And so in a live action script, like, I would never write out a fight scene. You know, you do something evocative, you let people know what needs to happen in it. If there's a particularly cool move that you want to or need to see, you write that in there. But, you know, you can get away with writing, you know, this is no wirework ballet, it's all knees, elbows, and angry. Everyone knows what that fight is going to look like. My first episode of an animated show was Black Panther's Quest. My episode was basically one long fight scene that periodically changed venues and participants. And after my first draft, like, had to learn how to, like, no, spell out what's going on, because you have to do a lot more blocking on the page, as opposed to, you know, if I was writing something for Eureka or The Middleman, the director's there, the cast's there, the stunt coordinator's there, they're going to work out what this is in a physical location. The physical location, until you say something in the script for animation, it's a blank square. So you can't count on, it's like, oh, we got to the location and there was this cool bridge that we decided to use. It's like, if you want a bridge, you got to write the bridge in there. And for puppets, it's slightly different because there you're writing for puppeteers. In one of the scripts, there was a line that, you know, I puppet Blanche, you know, the character Blanches. And Lisa Henson, like, comes in and it's like, you guys realize the puppeteers are just laughing at you. And we're like, well, why would they do? They seem like very nice people. Why are they doing that? And she's like, puppets can't blanch. And one of our upper level writers was like, well, an actor can't cause the blood to flow out of their face either. But, you know, if you saw that in a script, you know, you sort of know what's the facial, what are you doing with your body, that whole reaction. On the puppet side, and I suspect that part of this is that you have three people creating the physical reaction, you have to physicalize, you know, it's like startle, pulls back. You know, they want the action that we're gonna see on screen, because it's, I suspect that one of the reasons is it's less translation between the team that is creating the character. It's like they all know what a startle is gonna look like, as opposed to one person who thinks they're startling, one person is like, are we freezing? It's like, it's all there, it's settled. I've not actually talked to a puppeteer about that, so I could be entirely wrong, but what I learned is that, don't write that a character that is played by a puppet goes suddenly pale, because it'd have to be a special effects shot.
That's so interesting. I was going to ask you about Dark Crystal, because obviously, but I mean, I guess I was going to say, like, how was it writing for something that, like, has this history and, like, people love, but I guess, like, Lizzie Bennet is very similar, like...
Lizzie Bennet was kind of good practice for it, yeah. Because there's just so, like, when I could finally tell people that that's the project I was working on, like, the response, like, I got more likes to a photo I took of me standing next to a Skeksis than, like, anything that I had previously put online. And, you know, I met people who are like, you know, my sister is named Kira because of that movie. Or in one case, I'm not saying I named my daughter Kira because of that movie, but I love that movie and my daughter's name is Kira. And you know, it does have, it's like so invested in like beautiful stories of like people watching it and being terrified because they saw it when they were a little kid and loving it at the same time. And there's a lot of history. And, you know, we had, fortunately, we're doing it. I mean, you couldn't do it without the Jim Henson Company. So like, you know, Lisa Henson, you know, she's basically a production assistant on the original production, and now she runs the company. And so she was definitely there looking after her father's legacy, you know, as much as all of us were. It was also a little surreal because it was a show where we'd wrote all the scripts, and then production was, they did block shooting in London. So there was sort of this, like, I'd come to the writer's room and write the story, and I'd be working on my script, and I'd turn it in, and I'd do my drafts, and that was all, like, summer of 2017. So 2 years before the show actually came out on Netflix, and it was, like, sort of like, yeah, so that was that job we did, and now they've turned it into an actual show, and just, you know, it's so easy for things to fall apart at some point in production, and sort of like, yeah, here's the thing, and then it came out, and because of the gap, I told people, like, I feel like I'm allowed to be, like, super impressed about something that I worked on just because it's been so long, and they shot in London. I didn't get to go to set. I was invited to go to set, but I had to get myself to England, and that was not that was a long, expensive trip for me at the time that I'm now kind of really sad I didn't do. But it just all came out, and like every frame of that, like that Louis Leterrier shot, it's just, it's gorgeous. The work by the puppeteers is amazing. Jeff, our head writer, who was on set and doing like all of the production rewrites as it went, and that just did tremendous job. I'm so like, it seems bad to say amazed, but as cool as I thought it was when we were in our little writer's room on the Henson lot, it kind of knocked my socks off when I finally got to see it.
That's so cool. Man, you've been a part of some like really awesome things.
I cannot complain about, you know, franchises I've gotten to work on. No, I've been really fortunate in my career. I've worked on great projects with great people, so.
Well, you're a great writer, so I'm not surprised.
Aw, thank you.
Well, one last thing before we sign off. If you, I know this is like kind of a dumb question. I know that I get asked a lot, but if you were to give any like one piece of advice to young people looking to do what you do, what would you say?
I feel like the best advice I can give somebody who wants to be a writer, whether that means professionally, whether that means writing fanfic, whether that means just writing your own personal stories that you're going to show to a few close friends and that's all you ever want, just do it and keep writing. Yeah, you know, there are so many things, if you are pursuing, you know, writing or any creative career professionally, there is so much that is out of your control. And, you know, we talked earlier about Lizzie Bennett was the right people on the right project at the right moment. And there's so many right people on the right project and it's not the right time or something goes wrong. And the only thing that you can control is the work that you're putting out there and putting into it. So, yeah, do the best work you can and focus on, if you can be happy with your work, then it's a lot easier to roll with the ups and downs of whether it's commercially successful or recognized for awards. Like, all of that is great, but it's not a goal that you can set out after. Words a day, getting the pages done, submitting your stuff, those are all the things that you can control. So that's where you need to try to put as much energy as you can there and less towards the other stuff.
Yeah, I think that's great. That's all I know to tell people to do too, is just find ways to do it and keep doing it, because that's all you can do.
I once told somebody, it's like, oh, how did you break in? I'm like, I won the war of attrition. I stuck around long enough so when the opportunity was here, I was still here waiting for it.
That's so true. Well, thank you, Margaret. This has been such a joy to chat with you and reminisce with you. And I think you've given us just such good insight into what your career looks like as a writer, and great tidbits that I think our audience will really be excited to hear. So thank you.
No, well, thank you so much for having me. It was really nice chatting with you.
Oh, it was such a pleasure. And where can people follow you and find you if they want?
Yeah, people can find me online. I do have a webpage at margaretdunlap.com. It says, look, it's a webpage right at the top. It's mostly links to other places to find me. So you can follow me on Twitter or Instagram. I am at SpyScribe on both of those. Though I'm not very active on Instagram. It's mostly pictures of food and my plants.
Well, thank you so much, Margaret.
Yay! It was great to be here.
So happy to have you.
All right, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that talk with Margaret. She's just so lovely, and I should catch back up with her again sometime soon. It's been a while since we talked, but I so appreciated having her on the pod, and I so appreciated her giving me her blessing to share this interview publicly. As always, if you like this show, there are lots more episodes available on my Patreon at the $8 level, and your patronage helps me stay afloat in these unsure times, and helps me create more of this show. This month on Patreon, my guest is Sarah Kylie, who is an artist and animator who animated the opening sequence of Headless, A Sleepy Hollow Story, a show that I produced that came out last year. And this is just another reminder to go check out my Kickstarter for Hobbit Houses of America, if that's something that sounds good to you. August 20th is the last day that you'll be able to pledge, and help me go see some Hobbit Houses and make a show about it. That sounds fun, right? I hope so. I'm excited and nervous. All right, everybody, thanks so much for listening. And I'll see you in a couple weeks for more Dear Old World. Have a good one.